Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine, who takes a critical look at newly elected Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and the prospects for peace in the Middle East. Investigative journalist Carl Grossman, who examines the Bush administration's drive to build a national missile defense system and the danger that its deployment could spark a new global nuclear arms race. And Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat of Ohio, who describes the Congressional Progressive Caucus tax plan, which, unlike the Bush administration tax proposal, will provide the largest share of relief to working-class families and those on limited incomes. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Over the next several months, drug law reform will take center stage in New York State, where over 22,000 prison inmates are serving stiff sentences enacted in 1973 under guidelines established by former Governor Nelson Rockefeller. By the late 1990s, the Rockefeller drug laws were being criticized by prison reformers, activists, and several former Republican legislators for sentencing nonviolent offenders to a harsh 15 years to life and giving mandatory prison time for carrying 4 ounces or more of hard drugs, such as heroin or cocaine. Today, nearly 80% of inmates sentenced under New York drug laws come from poor Black and Latino neighborhoods in New York City. In January, Republican Governor George Pataki, who is a passionate supporter of the death penalty, proposed reducing some of the harsh sentences for nonviolent drug offenders and increasing the availability of drug treatment in jails. Pataki wants to increase penalties on so-called drug kingpins, who now mostly escape the wrath of the Rockefeller drug laws, which often snare only low-level drug operatives. Led by the Correctional Association of New York, a longtime prison reform group, drug reformers are pushing for a total repeal of the Rockefeller drug laws. Activists want the harsh minimum sentences to be abolished and the power of drug sentences to be returned to judges and taken away from powerful district attorneys. Robert Gagne, head of the Correctional Association of New York, comments, "The kingpins know enough not to carry drugs. It is the foot soldiers who literally get caught holding the bag and who face long, hard prison time." The Nation magazine reports that the dividing line between city and suburb is starting to fray. The new firewall is between the older, decaying blue-collar suburbs and outlying boom towns that are jammed full of malls and office parks. For example, drive north of Minneapolis, and the first layer of suburbs you see are falling apart. There are check-cashing stores, day labor agencies, pool halls, and a social service agency housed in an old 7-Eleven store. In the suburb of Brooklyn Center, over half of the public school students are eligible for free school lunches. Yet, not far away on the interstate, the town of Eden Prairie is booming. It has new highways. Farmland is giving way to a blockbuster video store, fast food outlets, and new corporate office parks. In addition, affluent suburbanites are moving into new $500,000 homes. State Representative Myron Orfield, a Minneapolis Democrat, sees trouble ahead. He told The Nation magazine, "Many suburbs are actually more fragile than the center cities. No one wants to live in these inner suburbs once they start to decline. You won't find yuppies moving into neighborhoods full of 1950s and 1960s homes with no woodwork and no hardwood floors." With his new book, Metropolitics, A Regional Agenda for Community and Stability, Orfield is rallying community activists and local officials across the nation to promote a regional approach to combating economic decay that unites city and blue-collar suburbs. There are now organizing projects to promote regionalism in Minneapolis-St. Paul, Cleveland, Chicago, and Portland, Oregon. Latin music is one of the fastest-growing markets, especially Tejano, a variation of the Tex-Mex sound. But while performers like Ricky Martin and Jennifer Lopez are doing well, many Tejano musicians are struggling just to eke out a living. This, according to Mother Jones magazine, which chronicled the friction between labels like Sony Discos and EMI Latin and the artists who record for them. Since 1930, the American Federation of Musicians, the AFM, has maintained a collective bargaining agreement called the Phonograph Record Labor Agreement, or PRLA, with most recording companies. This agreement stipulates that musicians working a 3-hour session will receive at least $302, along with additions to pensions and health plans. Unfortunately, Tejano musicians are lucky to get $50 a session, no matter how long it lasts. Economically, if a sub-label ignores this obligation to artists, then it can hang on to a larger piece of the profits. It's a position that gives the label the best of both worlds. As a subsidiary, it has access to world markets through its parent company, and as a spin-off, it can avoid entangled agreements. In 1997, the AFM began a campaign it calls Support Tejano Advancement in Recording, or STAR. So far, numerous celebrities such as Edward James Olmos, Robin Williams and Bonnie Raitt have signed on. The AFM has also considered the possibility of a strike, although no action is now planned. Tao Rodriguez Seeger, the grandson of Pete Seeger, sees it as an essential labor issue, explaining, "When you trim the fat away from the romanticism of music, then it becomes a job, with all the requisite baggage of any job." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Rich Fraser. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
With the Oslo peace process all but dead, and newly elected Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon promising no new concessions to Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, prospects for peace in the Middle East look very bleak. Amidst the violence of the latest intifada, or uprising, that has claimed over 400 Palestinian lives, Ariel Sharon, the leader of the right-wing Likud party, easily defeated incumbent Labour Party Prime Minister Ehud Barak. While Sharon received 62% of the ballots cast, the turnout in this election was the lowest in Israeli history. A deadlock in the Israeli parliament has pushed leaders of both Labor and Likud into negotiating a future national unity government. Many observers fear that former General Sharon, widely condemned for his complicity in the 1982 massacre of hundreds of Palestinian civilians at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Beirut, will aggravate the current crisis with his hardline policies and quite possibly trigger a dangerous regional war. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine, a bi-monthly Jewish critique of politics, culture, and society, who takes a critical look at Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's personal history and the prospects for peace in the Middle East.
Well, I think they weren't so much casting their ballots for Ariel Sharon as against Ehud Barak and the failure of his promises to bring peace. And some of those people were certainly hardcore right-wingers who have never really supported, never believed that peace was really possible with the Palestinians or with any of the Arab states. There's a strong percentage of Jews who believe that that is always going to be impossible. On the other hand, a significant percentage of those who voted for Barak were people who actually would have wanted peace, but felt that Barak had, in effect, shown that peace was impossible because Barak himself represented that he had made the most generous possible offers to the Palestinian people, and that the Palestinians had rejected this. And that made it possible for many people to believe the story of the right, which is that the Palestinians really don't want peace. They only want to push Israel into the sea. And that so Barak actually created this dynamic because he represented what he had offered to the Palestinians as the only and best rational policies that could possibly be given to Palestinians, and their rejection could only be understood as irrational and destructive.
Who is Ariel Sharon? Most listeners will know he was implicated in the 1982 massacres of Palestinian civilians at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon. Yeah. But I wonder if you'd just give us a brief profile of the man who now leads Israel.
Well, I mean, I can tell you that this is a man who has had a long history of violence, and actually he was described by Ben-Gurion and other leaders as a loose cannon. he came to be well known, but because he was a leader in the Israeli army in the 1950s when his units attacked a settlement of Arabs in the desert near Gaza and wiped out, I think it was 34 or 35 human beings who were just massacred by his units that were under his control. And there was no particular reason to do this. It was a terror tactic that was to scare other Arabs who might possibly be thinking of crossing from Gaza into the previous lands in which they were as Bedouins traveling around. And so he came to be known in the Israeli army as this very wild killer, basically. I mean, I laugh because I think that now I hear people talking about a new Sharon, but there has never been, and somebody said to me the other day, well, don't Jews believe in teshuva, which is the Hebrew word for repentance? And I said, absolutely, but there's never been any indication that he has repented any of his acts of violence or any of the terrorism that he's been engaged in. And so he has a long history of blood on his hands. Of course, the Sabron Shatila one is more well known because that was one which was condemned not just around the world, but by the Israeli government itself. He was forced to resign from his position as defense minister.
What in your mind has to happen as preconditions for a viable long-term solution to the conflicts between Israel and the Palestinians?
What we're saying is very simply, and we've been saying this all along, Israel has to get out of the West Bank and Gaza. It's got to dismantle the settlements, or if it won't dismantle the settlements, it's got to say to the settlers in those settlements, okay, you can stay in your settlements, but these are going to be part of Palestine, and you have to live as a minority within Palestine, obeying their laws and not expecting the Israeli army to come in and save you when some of you are prosecuted for the crimes of grabbing land that you've grabbed over the course of the past 10 or 15 years, or of assaulting Palestinians, which you've been doing, or any of the other crimes that would be punished in any other place in the world. Don't expect the Israeli army to come in and save you. The second thing is Israel has to agree to share Jerusalem. And sharing Jerusalem means that the Palestinians have to have unimpeded access to their holy site. I don't believe that that should mean that Jews don't equally have unimpeded access to our holy site. There's no reason why that can't happen, and both sides can agree to that. The third thing is that Israel has to acknowledge responsibility, not the only responsibility, but major responsibility for creation of the Palestinian refugee problem. It has to acknowledge the responsibility and agree to some limited form of return. When taken together, they would satisfy the Palestinian people, end the conflict, and give Israel the security that it absolutely needs and deserves.
That was Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine. Contact Tikkun at area code 415-575-1200. Or visit their website at www.tikkun.org. As promised during his campaign, George W. Bush is marching full speed ahead to build a 21st century model of the Reagan-era Star Wars program. The drive to construct the multi-billion-dollar national missile defense system comes as Russia, China, and many European nations are voicing strong opposition, expressing the fear that a U.S. intercept missile program will abrogate the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty and spark a new global nuclear arms race. The weapons program, justified by its supporters as necessary to defend against sneak attacks by so-called rogue states like North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, has been condemned by scores of arms control officials, scientists, and 50 Nobel laureates. The technical viability of Star Wars has also come into question after multiple test failures and allegations that aerospace corporations attempted to cover up or minimize the system's malfunctions. Before becoming the Bush administration's Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld chaired the Commission to Assess U.S. National Security Space Management. Hinting at a long-range plan going far beyond mere missile defense, the Rumsfeld Commission advocated America embark on a comprehensive program to establish military superiority in outer space. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with investigative journalist Carl Grossman, who examines the drive to build a national missile defense system and the danger that its deployment could undermine global strategic balance and stability.
As anticipated, it's full speed ahead on Star Wars now with Bush. I think it's important to note that Star Wars had not died under the Clinton administration. Indeed, late last year, the development program on the space-based laser project, which one military document describing that as a $20 to $30 billion, that's the life cycle budget, as it's put in this particular military document from the Huntsville Army Arsenal, describes it. That got the go-ahead under the Clinton administration on November 20th, when we still had the Clinton administration. And I mean, the nations of the world are quite aware about what the U.S. is up to. And it's far more than just missile defense. What the U.S. scheme is to control space. That's the word used over and over again in military documents. And from the, quote, ultimate high ground of space to dominate the planet below. And as I said, the nations of the world are quite familiar with the scheme. Indeed, it's on the Internet. I mean, anybody can go to the U.S. Space Command site and see the plans and documents like Vision for 2020 or Long Range Plan. And a vote was held at the United Nations on November 20th to reaffirm the Outer Space Treaty, which it's a visionary law of which the U.S. was a leader in enacting, which sets aside space for peaceful purposes. And it's been a success so far. Keep war out of space. Well, the vote was 163 at the U.N. to reaffirm the Outer Space Treaty, and specifically its provision that space be kept for peaceful purposes. The United States abstained. Now, this is under Clinton. Now under George W. Wow, it's I think the best idea of what's ahead, unless we stop it all, and I think that's what we really have to put our energies into, comes through the just about 3 weeks old now, the report of what's being called the Rumsfeld Commission or the Space Commission, and it outlines the scheme. I mean, just here I have pages in front of me. In the coming period, the U.S. will conduct operations to, from, in, and through space in support of its national interests, both on Earth and in space. As I say, far more than missile defense. Now, that's all we're hearing from, if we're hearing anything at all from the mainstream media, missile defense. Here they talk about the president should have the option to deploy weapons in space to deter threats and, if necessary, defend against attacks on U.S. interests. Here's a transform U.S. military capabilities to power projection in, from, and through space. The report goes on proposing the creation of a U.S. Space Corps, like the Marine Corps, to be the warriors in space, and then in a few years, possibly, that should change. There should be a transition, and the Space Corps become the Space Department, like the Department of the Army, the Department of the Navy, the Department of the Air Force, a new and separate service. So there we are. We're moving. The United States is now, and it's not just the military. We have a national administration, which with the military and the aerospace corporations and the ultra-conservative think tanks, Heritage and so forth, all pulling together, pushing together to turn the heavens into a war zone, basically.
Russia and China have articulated a position which opposes in any way, shape, or form a missile defense system such as the one envisioned by George W. Bush. What's your view of how stoppable or unstoppable this march towards this new era of space weaponry is?
Well, it's going to take a grassroots movement nationally and internationally to stop it. Once we move into space with the lasers and all this other stuff that the new Bush administration wants, the hypervelocity weapons and the particle beam weapons and so forth and so on, you're going to see the Russians and the Chinese meet us in kind, and the Indians will be up there with weapons, and we, the United States, is going to precipitate as we stand at the dawn of a new century, a new millennium, the start of an arms race in space, and ultimately, inevitably, thus war in space, and no one will profit other than Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Raytheon and DRW, the principal contractors, the aerospace companies, the principal contractors in Star Wars.
That was investigative journalist Carl Grossman. For more information, contact the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space at area code 352-337-9274 or visit their website at www.space4peace.org. That's space, the number 4, peace.org. As the nation enters into debate on the Bush administration's $1.6 trillion tax cut proposal, Democratic Party leaders have yet to announce details of their alternative plan. But members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus have put forward an initiative that they call the American People's Dividend. The plan calls for a simple $300 across-the-board tax rebate for every American man, woman, and child. The Progressive Caucus estimates that their tax cut plan will cost about $900 billion over 10 years. Critics of the Bush plan, including the conservative Wall Street Journal, have pointed out that the White House proposal reserves 40% of the tax benefits for the wealthiest 1% of the population and will spend a projected budget surplus that years down the road may not materialize. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat of Ohio, who chairs the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Congressman Kucinich describes the Progressive Caucus tax plan, which, unlike the Bush administration tax proposal, will provide the largest share of relief to working-class families and those on limited incomes.
Well, the Progressive Caucus proposes giving about $300 to every American man, woman, and child. And unlike the administration's tax plan, which gives something mostly to people in the top brackets, our dividend gives the same thing to everybody. And, for example, the proposal by the president reserves about 43% of the tax benefits to those in the upper 1% income. Our proposal would give the upper 1% 1%, and it enables an equitable distribution of the resources. You remember during the campaign, the president spoke to the American people over and over saying that it's your money, I want to give the money back to you. We helped with our plan to effect, I believe, what the president really wants to do, and that is to have everyone benefit. And I think that our approach, which would give $300 back to each and every American man, woman, and child, regardless of age, you know, the young, the old, everyone would benefit because, after all, every person is important in this economy. Unfortunately, at the moment, the president's tax plan doesn't accomplish a fair distribution. As a matter of fact, the distribution is skewed. It gives the benefits mainly to those in the top bracket.
Some might ask, why a tax cut at all? We have so many people uninsured in this country with no health insurance. Education in many places in this country is in tatters because of declining funding. How do you argue in favor of a tax cut when so much needs to be done and there's a recession, according to many economists, looming on the horizon?
Well, first of all, I don't think we need to talk ourselves into a recession. Secondly, there is a $2.7 trillion surplus, which is what President Bush is talking about. Our plan would involve giving back about $900 billion of that to the American people in the form of a tax rebate, which they would get each and every year that the surplus is in effect. If there's no surplus, there's no rebate. And then the other money, the $1.8 billion which remains, would go towards helping to shore up Social Security and Medicare, and would go to meet the other needs of the country, including a prescription drug benefit and spending for education. So there's a significant amount of money which is in the surplus. We advocate giving only a portion of it back and using the rest to provide for economic security.
We were speaking with John Kavanaugh of the Institute for Policy Studies recently, who says there is a battle ongoing for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. And as the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, I wonder how you see the 2000 election and the future direction of the Democratic Party.
I think the Progressive Caucus is going to have a wonderful opportunity to offer a range of policy alternatives for the Democratic Party. And this isn't so much about ideology as it is about just doing the right thing for the American people, making sure that everyone can have a good education and decent health care and decent housing and job security and retirement security. These are all things that every American strives for. Government must relate to people's practical aspirations. And a two-party system, if it's to have any relevancy at all, has to have a way of producing plausible alternatives which meet people's practical aspirations. So that's what we're going to work on in the Progressive Caucus, and we hope to become a force within the Democratic Party for positive economic change and to develop the kind of viable alternatives which people are looking for. There's clearly a time for some new ideas and a new approach to government, and that's why we offered this this tax plan. We have a chance to give people some of their money back. That's fine, but we can do more than that. If the economy takes a downturn, we can provide a stimulus with our plan. If the economy stays solid, people can continue to get money back. Each year, the surplus is in effect. So there's a great opportunity for America to move forward and that everyone can benefit. That's the beauty of this country. There's a framework here where it can truly be government of the people, by the people, and for the people, and that means all the people. And I'm hopeful to be able to play a role in that as the chairman of the Progressive Caucus.
That was Representative Dennis Kucinich, Democrat of Ohio. Contact the Congressional Progressive Caucus at area code 202-225-5871 or visit their website at progressive.house.gov. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Rich Frazier, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Curry.